Hello. So this is the Edge Cases podcast. My name is Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is the second podcast that we are recording. We're recording on Friday, May 25th, which, unlike our last podcast, is not a holiday. However, it is the start of the Memorial Day holiday weekend, so there's that.
Okay, so we have to figure out a joke to work in about the Memorial Day weekend. Okay.
Yeah,
no pressure.
Yes, no pressure. Yes, and a Memorial Day themed title, if we can come up with one of those. So actually, for a podcast which has not actually yet been released to the public, it may be a bit surprising, but I do have some follow-up from last time around. So we'll get to that first. turns out there was something I said on the last podcast which was wrong. And in order to rectify this fact, I actually went ahead and wrote a blog post. So I have a blog post that's an apology for a podcast that no one's listened to yet.
Now, that's proactive.
And so I felt so bad about it. Actually, you know, we could have gone back and edited the old podcast since it hasn't been released yet. But I think that's where we're going to, you know, that's where we're going to show that this is how we're going to do our podcast. Where it's live. It's no edits. It's, you know, chips fall where they may.
We have the QA philosophy of Apple.
ouch. okay, so last time around, I said that there was a new core data model format in Xcode 4 that I had seen my model get changed to with an edit from me without it warning me about it. And that made my model file incompatible with older versions of Xcode without my choosing for it to do that. Now, it turns out that when I tried it again, I actually installed some older versions of Xcode, which is not easy, by the way. and I did that mostly.
That's an episode in itself.
Xcode is going to take up a bunch of episodes. So technically, today is also an Xcode episode,
right.
but there you go. Anyway, I found that it was Xcode 4.1 was when this was introduced, and it turns out that it doesn't. I couldn't reproduce it changing the model without telling me about it, and so that was wrong about the what I said last time around. And so I have the post is called Upgrading to the Next Model, and it goes into a lot more details about it. And eventually it will even be updated with links to the first podcast where I actually said those things, making the cycle complete. But that's it for follow-up for this moment.
Really?
Although
I'm expecting another hour and a half of follow-up. Can you do that?
Give it time. Okay. Oh, give it time. actually, that is one thing I really like about podcasts is that they do let you correct mistakes without making a big deal of it. It's just, you know, just something you say. Mm-hmm. So, and that, you know, it's nice because I am a bit of a perfectionist, if you haven't noticed. And so, you know, if I don't have that chance, if I don't have that escape valve of being able to say, well, I'll just, anything I make an innocent mistake about, I'll correct it next time. If I don't do that, you know, we're never going to finish one of these because I'm never going to be satisfied with any one episode. One other thing to note is that I am blogging more now due to this podcast, which
right.
is great. I do. I like blogging. I just haven't gotten into the rhythm of it again, and so we'll see. And it's a little odd that the first two blog posts I've been making are actually complimentary towards Xcode 4. that might not have been your first thought as to what I would do. And there's actually at least one more complimentary post that I haven't written yet that I will before I get back into the criticism.
Is it because you really like the blueprint icons?
The blueprint icons?
Yeah, the famous blueprint icons for Xcode. The hammer and the app is like the app icon is on a blueprint. Have you never like looked at the large?
Oh yeah.
Icon?
Okay. Yeah, no, I have. I didn't tend to think of it as a blueprint, but I mean the hammer is the thing that you know tends to.
I wanted to not go with something as obvious as the hammer.
Yes, well, let's not talk about what the hammer signifies.
there you go.
Okay, so the topic today is Xcode for iPad. And I remember, Wolf, when you originally saw this in the list of topics that we were putting together, do you remember what your first thought was?
No, I don't. Hopefully you can remind me.
Maybe we
I'm
should
a very
yours.
Forward-thinking person. I don't have time to try yeah, right. what thoughts I had previously.
Yes, very Jobsian of you. what you had said was, well, hey, I would want to see, you know, more details about this.
Oh, sure.
And there were no more details because it was just something I just had the phrase come into my head, and that was it. So, but since then, I've come through with a lot more details about why it's interesting to talk about. And so there's three things that I want to go over with this concept of Xcode for iPad. One is, is it possible to do that? And the second is, what would or should it look like? Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to talk a little bit at the end about how likely it is. So the first two I'm going to kind of mix in and out of what will be the main section of the podcast, talking about a couple of things here. So let's see. So when the iPhone first came out, I remember joking with coworkers about how, you know, Xcode for iPhone would just be a big red button, right? You just, you know, build, bam, get it, and you build, and that would be it. And I guess the idea behind that was more, you know, kind of the iPhone as a remote for building. You know, you wouldn't build on the iPhone, but it would be a way to trigger a build. And there is some validity to that concept as a developer tool concept. But I do think that that would be most useful for people who already have the infrastructure set up, people working at larger or I guess also maybe smaller companies where, you know, they have remote builds set up. And that's pretty common, but it's not sort of everyone. It's not something that you could say, you know, hand someone an iPad and say, you know, here's your Xcode. Well, if all Xcode does is something that requires a lot of other setup, well, then it's not very useful. So this brings me to the first of, I think there are going to be about five rules for what I would consider to be Xcode for iPad, which is that if you're going to do Xcode for iPad, it's got to be self-enclosed. And it's got to, so you've got to be able to give this to someone and just have them use it. Or it's just not going to be what I think Apple would want out of an Xcode for iPad.
So basically no Mac required kind of thing?
No Mac required, okay. Right. And I think they've gone that route with their other Pro Tools that they've come up with, Aperture or iWork or other things. It can be useful to take your result and bring it back to a Mac, but they don't tend to come up with apps that require it. I don't think. Now, of course, you know, maybe people will come at me after this and, you know, with, oh, you know, there's this thing and that thing. But I don't think so. I think that's it. And I think the reason for that is because they really do want this to be a new world. And if you had to tie it into the Mac, then it's not a new world. It's an adjunct to the old world, which they already tied with Newton, right? And no, we're not going to do that. And so then, but then as an adjunct to that, if you are going to do it all in the device, then you can't have the iPhone be the device, you know, because again, most of what you could fit on an iPhone would be just a big red button. And that's it. Mm-hmm. So rule number two is this is going to be an iPad app, right? Well, that comes with the title because we said Xcode for iPad, but just to be sure, a lot of times, you know, obviously there can be universal apps. And I think things like iPhoto, right, is also an iPhone app in addition to an iPad app.
That's right.
And then there's also, what was the other one that they did that was really a bit surprising?
Maybe
like iMovie.
Okay.
Maybe Keynote. I don't remember if Keynote's out for the iPhone, but like iMovie, I think was one where like I edit movies on an iPhone. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can do that, but I don't think you can do Xcode on that due to just needing the screen real estate and other things that we'll be going into. Okay, so now let's define what this means. Xcode being an IDE, you need to do what at least three things. You need to edit your source code. You need to build into the application. Then you need to debug the app. Mm-hmm. And then also the other one is submitting, which is something very specific to what Apple does, but also something that would be pretty much required for an Xcode for iPad. And in terms of these kind of steps, in terms of these sort of creative endeavors, my next point was, you know, people have been talking for a long time now about whether the iPad is something for creation or consumption, right?
Right.
And I think actually, I'm not sure actually like real people care about this very much, but a lot of pundits have been talking about it. And I know John Gruber of Daring Fireball has waged a sustained campaign of mockery at the people who are favoring the concept of mostly consumption. And he points to a lot of these apps which do a lot of very interesting things for that creators can use, writers, artists, etc. But when you think about what an IDE does, it does more than one thing. And my point, and I have a post about this called "The Lovers, the Dreamers, and Me," and I'll have that link in the show notes. And when was that? That was back in March of 2011. My thinking on this was, well, everyone seems to be emphasizing, well, no, creators can do just fine on the iPad. Well, they can do just fine until you need to integrate things, until you need to do more than one thing easily, switching quickly between tasks and using the input of one task for the output of one task for the input of the next. And so that was sort of my post is, hey guys, don't go overboard with this idea that creators can just use an iPad for everything. And Gruber himself mentions this in his own post from this month called iOS Low-Hanging Fruit. Mm-hmm. He specifically mentions, yes, one of the low-hanging fruit is better inter-app communication. And so since that problem has not been solved yet, if an IDE needed to do all these things in different applications, well, then you'd be kind of sunk. Then, okay, you can't do this on the iPad. Luckily it's an integrated development environment, not a disintegrated development environment. Yes, I was quite happy when I proud of myself when I thought of that one. And even on the Mac side, if you had all these different utilities to do these three or four different things, they could talk to each other, then you couldn't do it on the Mac either. But at the very least, the first question is, can we do this? Is this possible? Yes. Even without plucking that low-hanging fruit, an Xcode application would be possible because all of those pieces could talk to each other within the same app. Mm-hmm. Then the second bit was, it's possible to do the infrastructure of it, but what about the UI? And on the UI side, there's a couple of apps that I want to talk about as prototypes for Xcode. And this is the way I tend to come at things. I tend to say, well, if I want to do something new, what's the model for it first? What can we look at as people who I can learn from to start off with? And then you build on that or you come up with something, you riff off of that maybe to do something new. And so there's a couple things here. And then the disclaimer is all of these apps, I've used them for a couple of minutes. And usually not even that. So a lot of this is coming from third parties. So let's take that first task, the editing. when I asked around, it seems like the code editor that most people use on the iPad is something called Textastic. Mm-hmm. Textastic, yes. Textastic. And I've also had a colleague of mine use it in front of me. Let's see. The big thing that I saw there, actually, there are two things. One was that it had a toolbar above the keyboard, which had a couple of interesting things that it could do. It had buttons which had both a beginning and ending braces and brackets in them. And so you would sort of put your finger down on a button and then flick it to the left to make an opening bracket and then flick it to the right to make a closing bracket. And that's kind of an interesting way to cram more punctuation into the keyboard than you could normally get. I'm not sure I'd really buy it myself. I think if I were writing a lot of Objective-C code in the iPad, that kind of flicking that I'd have to do all the time wouldn't work for me as a workflow, as a way to do things quickly. Mm-hmm. But it shows that people are thinking about it. But the other thing is, what they did was, well, if you plug in an external keyboard, then that the software keyboard doesn't show up, which means the extra bar doesn't show up either. Mm-hmm. And I think got me thinking. If I am going to be typing a lot on the keyboard, I would probably want an external keyboard for this. Mm-hmm. So whatever Xcode for iPad, whatever it does, whatever it supports. I'd probably want it to work well with that external keyboard. And that would mean that whatever you put in that bar would have to be something that you either can do with the external keyboard or through some other means. So for example, that external keyboard then has, the extended keyboard, lots of punctuation symbols. Well, then you're all set. We'll see. about that. And I haven't actually tried external keyboards for the iPad. Have you tried any?
Not at all. I don't have an iPad.
You don't have an – oh, okay, that's going to be another topic. I don't think we have time for it today. But certainly that would make that a lot easier. So again, that, I would consider that to be rule number three, that I would need an external keyboard, and therefore the Xcode for iPad would need to work well with it. And Textastic also had an interesting little doodad on the screen for more complex selections. I think that's also a good idea. You know, again, you do most of your selection through keyboard shortcuts, which won't be possible on the iPad. So anything to make that go faster would also be good.
Yeah, you're talking about like the little arrow floater roundy thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, I haven't played with it myself, but I think something like that would be pretty essential. The second app I tried to use was, or at least looked at, was Diet Coda.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a lot of people really like Coda. People have been trying out Diet Coda. And sort of like what Xcode B, it is its own IDE. It's trying to be sort of the entire puzzle, not just a piece of it. I did buy it, but I couldn't use it because it actually requires a website to use. You can't kind of have a dummy site. But I did look through the promotional video, and it has some interesting things there. So first of all, the website says make quick fixes on the go. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about that is it's not positioning itself as a complete replacement for the desktop app. It's kind of selling itself as, you know, something you do in addition. Except it's not really in addition. It's not that you need the desktop app. It's just that you wouldn't use this to edit your website all the time, just mm-hmm. sometimes, which makes sense. On the other hand, they also sell Coda. So I think from a promotional standpoint, they wouldn't necessarily want to say, you know, buy this small app instead of buying our Mac app, because, of course, the Mac app costs a lot more. So it may be that that's more of a branding thing rather than a necessary aspect of it. But I suppose we'll see. There's a huge amount of functionality, even just mentioned, shown in the video. The IDE, there's a lot of switching around in different contexts, different views. You could edit files in one view, and then there's a file management pane that you can swoop in. There's terminal, another pane that you can switch to, and just a lot of stuff. And that brought to mind that Xcode is going to need a lot of that context switching as well, because Xcode has to do most of those things too. It needs to do file management and projects. You need to be able to look at output from things. I don't have a lot of time here, but Xcode 4 has a lot of problems with this in my mind, because they tended to squeeze a lot of things into static places on the screen. Things don't really swoop out and swoop in Xcode 4. Things are in their defined place, and then if you want to bring them out, you have to bring them out yourself. Mm-hmm. I won't go into too many details today, but I think Xcode for iPad would need to learn more from Diet Coda to make that happen, because you know you just can't have those impediments on the iPad. On the Mac, if you need to do a few extra keystroke shortcuts to make things work, well, okay, that's, you know, you can live with that. But you just can't live with that on the iPad. So rule number four was no UI fiddling. And I think, again, the fact that lots of third parties are doing this well, I don't remember if Apple is really getting a lot of high marks for this, but I do know that, you know, they're rethinking their apps when they go on the iPad. They've been getting high marks for that. So mm-hmm. hopefully they could do that here as well. Okay. And then looking at debugging as the third task on there, I also looked at Codea, which is supposed to rhyme with IDEA, I guess. It used to be Codify. And that's also an IDE of sorts, and actually the closest in kinship to Xcode, because it makes full-fledged apps. But those apps are really kind of interpreter-based apps. They only do a certain number of things. They have their own custom drawing routine, et cetera. So while it's very interesting, and actually the thing that's most interesting about it is that when you debug an app in Codea, it actually takes over part of your screen to show you the debugger stuff. There's terminal. There's a section for the terminal output from your application. And there's also a section for showing like customized UI for changing the variables in your script, which is very interesting. Little sliders to make the values get larger or smaller. And that's very interesting for what it does, but it's also a very specialized thing. I can't imagine. And you know, in the script, these are global values for what's shown on the screen. And in your app, obviously, you probably wouldn't have too many globals in your Objective-C app.
Hopefully not.
So, right. So while I really like the idea of having there be less typing in order to modify things, because you know, if you want to modify something on the fly in Xcode for Mac, you could do that. It just involves a lot of typing, a lot of setup. That just wouldn't be quite so possible on the iPad. But I don't know exactly how to make it happen just yet. But even just that idea of having this thing that comes over your app, obscures part of it to show you your output. It's obviously you can't do that with your own regular apps. Your regular app is going to need to take over the whole screen. So it occurs to me that if you wanted to have something that came over the screen, you know, on let's say a certain unused gesture or something like that, that would involve system APIs, system hooks that not every app could have. So while a lot of the things we've talked about so far mean that Xcode could be written by anybody because a single app does all the things you need to do. But here you're kind of saying, well, you really need something that only Apple could write Xcode from the requirements we've put in so far. Mm-hmm. I guess you could have a thing where your app is running and then when you hit a breakpoint in the debugger, it switches context to your app. I think that just wouldn't work in the long run. You really need to be able to see stuff and interact with it without the app going into the background, for example. I think that would be very important. So I went through, editing, a little bit talk about editing, a little bit of talk about debugging. Now let's talk about building. Here's where we really come down to do or die. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, you just can't imagine, I can't imagine, putting the entirety of the build system of Xcode into the iPad. I can imagine, in the sense of, you can't build a large-scale app on your iPad. Just can't do it. You don't have the memory, don't have the horsepower, etc. And I guess I don't really have anything to back that up with, except just common sense. But there you go. I'm going to make it a rule anyway. Rule number five, you can't have the full build system on the iPad. And in parentheses in my notes, I put no building Photoshop. Right. You just can't. You can't build Photoshop. So what can you do? Well, maybe you could put in the build system and just limit it in some fashion, because most iOS apps are not Photoshop. They're a lot smaller. So you'd still need, maybe you could say, okay, we're going to put in the full build system, but we're going to rate limit it. You know, if you have more than 100 files, maybe we'll say, hey, this isn't realistic. You're going to burn out your iPad. You're going to use up all your battery. You know, don't do it here. Go to your Mac. It's one option. I probably wouldn't fly, but it's one option. Another option is do less work. And the thing I came up with here was per method compilation. So for right now, when you change something about a file, it needs to rebuild the whole thing, the whole .o file again. But you know, the Clang folks are real smart. And if you took, a team within the LLVM group and you said, okay, go off for a year and figure out all the ways that you can make it such that, you use the very least amount of horsepower and battery and everything else on your iPad, but you still build, they could probably make a lot of strides in that to make that better. So there's that. I mean, I would hope that they could make that worthwhile, but we'd have to see. And then the last thing to mention here is that the build tools, I was saying before, so debugging would probably require that this is Apple making it. Build tools, they also require that Apple makes it. There's secret sauce going on that you just can't have third-party tools do. I believe even there's this is something that's done in the notes yet, I'll have to add it. There's an app out there that someone has written in Java that lets you build native apps.
Are you talking about app code?
App code, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that you have to have either you have to have Xcode installed in addition, or it only makes Mac apps and it doesn't make signed ones, something like that. Like, there's certain things you can do, but you wouldn't be able to make iOS apps with it. That's my assumption. I guess I should look that up before I make that a rule. But
I have a couple friends that are using AppCode, some willingly, some unwillingly, and I don't know. I assume that it's probably. I know that these guys also have Xcode installed. They start with Xcode, so I wouldn't be surprised if they require an Xcode installation. It seems not like a large hurdle to require that, since obviously all the sample code and documentation tends to come with Xcode anyway. So,
right. Oh, exactly. It's not a big deal in terms of requirements on your Mac, but obviously it would be a big deal if you said, well, you know, I want something on the iPad and Apple doesn't give me the tools on the iPad. You're done. You can't do it. So the other option for building, instead of, you know, taking a whole bunch of client engineers and saying, make this better, is something that I know, Wolf, you and I had talked about when we first discussed this topic, which was the possibility of, and this kind of goes back to the beginning, you know, my original idea for Xcode for iPhone was a button that builds something somewhere else. We don't want to do that because we don't want to have to have you set it up. Well, what if you didn't have to set it up? What if your stuff was building on a server somewhere, but that server was Apple run? And it was basically an iCloud server. So I install Xcode for iPad on my iPad. And the first time I click build, it saves me some space over an Apple server. And it does it that way. So I still don't have to set anything up. I still don't have to pay for server time. I don't have to set up anything, the communication, anything like that. Apple does all that, but it's still offloading it from the iPad. And there's a lot of reasons why I think Apple would really like this, right? I mean, it would make submission easier, for example, because submission would mean just taking the built binary from one of their servers and taking it to another of their servers. Apple could run security. Oh boy!
I think you have to address the cat sooner or later, so you might want to dispatch it now.
Okay, so that is one of my cats meowing. Shut up!
And this will be a theme throughout pretty much all recorded episodes. Somehow we managed to record all of episode one without, even one stray meow. But let's consider it ambient background noise that you paid extra for. I'm sorry to derail you, but you were talking about how this, you know, Apple having the build servers would be a good thing for them.
Right. And the other thing would be right now they run security audits on the binary. But now, if they had all your code, they could run security audits on the code itself.
No more weird method swizzling tricks to try and evade binary signature detection.
So I think Apple would like this, and of course it would take resources on their servers, but they seem to be pretty free with that at the moment anyway. And of course other people would not like it so much. People would say, well, I want to be, you know, I don't want other people to see my code. And there's the chance that Apple, so there are security concerns that, we'll just leave it at that for now. Yeah. You know, but that's the thing. Like Apple could pretty much say, well, you have to do this. And I think that in terms of people, people have already accepted quite a bit from Apple in terms of requirements that would seem onerous if anyone else applied them, or onerous for regular desktop development. I think a good chunk of people would sign up immediately for this.
I'm sure of it, yeah. And I'm sure we get some nice blog post scenes defending this and arguing that this is the way of the future.
Right. So I do think that that's pretty much that would be the path of least resistance for Apple to do it that way. Well, maybe not. It's certainly, again, it's an interesting idea for how they would get around some of these problems with how much resources it would take locally to do builds. And I think it would fit in with a lot of what Apple does. So that's pretty much okay. That's how and whether they could do that. At least in as much as you know, we have time for. We're already almost at the 30-minute mark. But then you know, is it likely to happen? And I guess, I mean, it could happen, but it's not particularly likely.
More really? Okay, because if you ask me about this, this is I'm surprised your prediction is so weak on this, because I would predict very strongly. In fact, I would almost peg this as inevitable, that if Xcode, not in name, but eventually we will have something like that on the iPad.
So that's the key there, is eventually. Mm-hmm. In a bunch of years, if OS X becomes more and more deprecated, which is going to happen, but we don't know when. Certainly, Apple is putting a decent amount of effort into OS X right now, to the extent where it's hard to imagine that all of the power users who are using the Macs now would just dump them in the next, I don't know what, 2 years. Now, if you say 5 years, or if you say 7 years or 10 years, that's a different story. I think what would happen, I think the reason Apple would do this is if they want to get their own engineers off of OS X. That's when they would start putting a lot of effort into it. You know, because obviously everyone who uses Xcode right now can't switch to an iPad. I think it's when that's going to happen will be when they'll put serious effort into this. And it's just a question of when. And if it's more than 5 years, you know, more than 5 years is, it's a lifetime in our industry. So lots of things could change by then. And so I think it's less interesting to talk about, oh, it's definitely going to happen in 7 years. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in 7 years. It would be more interesting if it were, oh, it's going to happen in two. And I think, you know, in that's the time frame where I'm saying it's unlikely. So, okay, hold on a second. So that's it. That's what I had to talk about from Xcode for iPad. And so we're a little over here, but did you have any responses to that?
Yeah, I would say that the entire the basic stance of Clang being too heavy to be put on iPad. I'm just thinking about all the code I wrote on my 400 megahertz Pismo G3, and I think probably iPad's faster than that, and I think probably has more memory. So the iPad's not a weak machine by any, especially the current generation. Now, granted, a lot of its current memory is soaked up by the Retina display, and it's definitely less memory starved than it used to be. And you're right, it doesn't have a lot to work with. But I would say for simple apps, which, you know, iOS apps tend to be on the simple side anyway, I think running Clang locally is not as big a deal as you're making out to be.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of hope so, because that would certainly make it's much more palatable to have a local Xcode, I think, than a remote Xcode. I'm tending to think of, you know, just all the stuff that you need to install when you install Xcode. So even if Clang itself could be run there, I don't know, just all the stuff you need to make it work. You know, install having a full developer tool install on your iPad. I don't know.
This reminds me of I recently read someone trying to get LaTeX working on the iPad, and like they're basically having to like modernize the code base or to get it running on iOS, because it's very depending of tools, calling tools and stuff like that. Because it's basically a development environment, and so along the same lines that these tools would have to be more integrated into a common binary. Although that said, this is Apple; they don't have to play by the rules, and they could totally have. And demons working in the background, and separate tools and binaries that they can call and all that. So they could just have this very fragmented tool chain that's typical of the Unix development environment, and just run it all in the background, and Apple can do it even though you can't.
Right. Yes. And also, and I do think it's worth emphasizing that that if Apple does want to make this happen, I mean, they really had to do the same thing with iOS at all. You know, because people were saying, well, you can't run a big iron Unix on, a little device. Mm-hmm. And they did it.
Right.
They did it by basically squeezing Unix till it, till it cried uncle, changing the things that they could get away with changing. So sure, they'd have to put a lot of effort into, getting rid of the cruft and just squeezing it all down. But they could.
Now, what about the, you know, obviously we all have, we're all running Xcode on the Mac, and we all have our current projects. The question is, would they keep the same file format? And if so, how do you shuttle things back and forth? I suppose they'd want to use iCloud for that, because they're probably not going to be adding Dropbox support.
Right. I mean, my call on this would be, they would have a new format that's, again, very optimized for what you need it to do on the iPad, that's not backwardly compatible, that you would use for Xcode for iPad projects. Now, while it wouldn't be backwardly compatible, you wouldn't be able to use it with old versions of Xcode, but you would be able to use it with new versions of Xcode for Mac.
Hmm.
You know, they give a new version for Mac that could run that project, same projects. You know, you'd be stuck if you didn't want to use, you know, the old Xcode 4, for example, if this is Xcode 5. But, you know, it's pretty easy to take something that's designed for the iPad and also make it work on Mac, because you're not as resource constrained on the Mac. The problem would be, you know, again, backwards compatibility, which Apple has shown that they're willing to forego.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's my take on how they do that.
Okay. Yeah, and obviously Xcode tends to be a bit of a beast in terms of resource consumption, but I think it's definitely reasonable to get it all on an iPad without actually having to run the Unix toolchain underneath the hood. Although I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Apple doesn't use this as saying, "Aha, this is a good point to go to the cloud," and yes, you send us your source code.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I don't know. Then that's the thing. I can't tell which way I think they would go with this, because I do think the cloud would be a big deal in terms of, you know, setting it up. Like, it would be something that would be a big thing. Like, they'd introduce that as, here's the next big thing.
So would they still call it Xcode, or would they call it iCode?
They've kept the names for the other major apps that they've brought over.
Right.
I think they would stick with the name, just because it would, I don't know, why do they do it for Aperture? Why do they do it for anything else? Would they do it so that people will move over? Like, for them, it was more important for them to move existing customers to the new platform with its functionality than to make a clean break. Is that important for Xcode? Dunno. Because Xcode's free, you know, obviously they're not trying to make money off of it. And I think by the time they would do it, there would be less of that concern of, well, we need to move people over. Then it would really be, well, we need to convince these crotchety old developers to do it, you know, enough of the ones who aren't convinced yet. And would they be more convinced by having it be called Xcode, or would they be more convinced by having it called something new? That I don't know.
Okay. I want to mention two other things. There is a historical precedent for this. When the Mac first came out, obviously it was too weakly a computer to develop for itself, and you're supposed to buy this, I think it was like $10,000 or something. I'm thinking probably 2FX or Next Machines. I think it was like $5,000. You're supposed to buy a Lisa to develop for the Mac. And wasn't it like MPW on Lisa or something before they ran on the Mac? But it was before my time. But the point is that you had to buy this beefy computer to develop for the smaller Macintosh. And eventually, of course, you had the indie developers, the Lightspeed Technologies, who eventually morphed into Think, that eventually bought up by Symantec, that gave you these IDs, like Think Pascal, for the Mac. And eventually Apple lumbered its way over and had its own development environments and all that. So this is very much kind of a replay of history. You're seeing these indie guys kind of getting into the field first and kind of having the code editing experience on the iPad. And like I said, it's just inevitable that the iPad will be beefy enough that you'll be able to develop directly for it.
Yep.
And, so, mm-hmm. Okay. And the other thing is that, I totally get what you mean in terms of, like, you know, you have a full screen iPad app and you hit your breakpoint. What happens? And again, because, you know, Apple owns the entire stack, they could totally do a hook where you swap in and out your context, all that. I could, you know, but you could also attach a different monitor to an iPad, so I could totally see them extending that where you have a secondary display. Or maybe this will say, guess what, you have to buy a second iPad, and that's your development environment. And when you hit build and go, guess what, you're firing up on that other iPad.
Yep.
Yeah, so I could see them totally that developers will have to have two iPads in order to get the real work done. I wouldn't be surprised if you can't do code editing and so forth just on your single iPad, but much like, it strikes me as very much like kernel debugging with how you have to have two machines to do it right. Obviously, developers don't have to haul around extra machines, but you know that's one way out of that mess.
Well, certainly that would allow you to do things like, you know, I have my build machine, which is, you know, an iPad, and then I have my test machine. Well, I want to test an iPhone app that I built on my iPad. Well, right. Of course, then you can't do it on the same machine. That makes total sense. That's a good point. Although I think whatever way they talk to each other would probably be proprietary. You know, they might even have their own cable, you know, that you have to buy from Apple to do it that way, because you can't really connect two iPads right now or two iOS devices directly. Mm-hmm. Maybe that'll come eventually too as a user feature for some reason. But that's a very good point.
Okay. And that's pretty much what I have on the topic. I'm sure I'll think a bunch of other debugging problems of that type of stuff later on, but you know, that's my two cents.
Cool. All right. So I think that covers it for this week. And so we will see you all on the next podcast. Again, my Twitter handle is apontius, APONTIOUS. And Wolf, do you want to give your Twitter handle, or you just wait to put that in the show notes?
Let's put it in the show notes.
Put it in the show notes. That's it.
There's a lot of consonants in there.
Yeah, that's true. And again, all of the things that I've been talking about, I talked kind of fast. Maybe you missed a few things. They will be in the show notes for this episode. And while we don't have that URL to give you on the air just yet, the URL for the whole website will be edgecasesshow.com, all run together. So great. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Okay. See you later. Bye.
Bye.